about the case from the Colombian Constitutional Court about the Río Atrato. And this case was brought in Colombia's Constitutional Court by a human rights NGO called Tierra Digna, and they brought it on behalf of a number of indigenous and Afro-descendant communities in Colombia. And in particular, the case relates to the Atrato River, which is in this area that's in the Oval, in the region of Chocó in Colombia. And it was an action de tutela, which basically means an action for the protection of constitutional rights under the Colombian Constitution. And I'll explain a bit more later which constitutional rights were the centre of the case. The decision was actually handed down in November of last year, but it didn't become public until about May this year, around about the time that we were hearing about what was going on in India and also Whanganui River, so very exciting times. For some geography, 98% of the population of Chocó belongs to an indigenous or Afro-descendant community, so really high percentage of indigenous or campesino peasant or Afro-descendant community. It's also the poorest region of Colombia, and around about 50% of Chocó lives in extreme poverty. It's also an area that has been ravaged by civil war in Colombia, also the drug war and just general organized criminal groups. So it's an area of Colombia that's had a really difficult history. The Atrato River is Colombia's longest river, and it's the third most navigable. So a bit like the Whanganui River in New Zealand, it's a strategically a very important river. The communities living beside the river depend on it and have depended on it for their subsistence and also for their economy, and in particular for agriculture, those communities that live next to the river. It, as you can hopefully see from this slide, is one of the most biodiverse parts of the planet, extremely rich biodiversity. And there is also gold and silver in the river. So you can probably see where I'm going with this. But artisanal mining has been really important and carried out even by some of the indigenous communities in the river. But since about the 1990s, we've had some more mechanized or organized mining that's taken place along the river. And that has been done illegally, so it's without any sort of permit or authorization from the Colombian government. And they're using dredges and excavators and heavy machinery. They're also using cyanide and mercury. And the Atrato River, in many parts, has more than 100 times the safe human level of mercury in the water. So that has led to extreme degradation of the river. It's destroyed the natural course of the river in many parts. It's flooded the rainforest in many parts. And obviously this issue with mercury and cyanide being in the river. So that's gotten into the food chain. It's affected traditional agriculture along the river, and it's led to massive displacement of many communities that live in this area. And the court in the Atrato case calls it one of the biggest humanitarian and environmental crises of Colombia's time. So what's the government been doing about this? Well, they've generally been pretty inactive in the region of Chocó generally, and they haven't taken action to stop this illegal mining. So you can see what the river is supposed to look like. This is virgin forest and what the river is supposed to look like. This is what it does look like now in many parts. This is where you can see the natural course of the river and inundation of forest. And these are the dredges, what they call dragones or dragons, which are responsible for a lot of the damage along the river. And these are dotted all the way along the river. So what does the court do in the decision? Well, it found that the state had violated the human rights of the communities living along the river, protected under the Constitution, by failing to stop the illegal mining on the Atrato River. And they said that it violated the right to life, the right to health, the right to water, the right to food security, the right to a clean environment, which was protected in the Colombian constitution, and also the right to culture and territory of the indigenous and Afro-descendant communities. And this is really interesting because the government can no longer just turn a blind eye to what's going on in this area. And the court's saying they have to actively protect the communities living there. The second thing which the court did, which is really interesting for us today, is that it recognised that the river is what it calls an entidad sujeto de derechos, which basically translates as a legal entity or a legal person or a legal subject. And it says that the rights of the river are rights to protection, conservation, management and restoration by the state and by the ethnic communities that live in the region. So those are the river's own rights as distinct from the rights of the community under the constitution. And then the court makes a number of orders in order to implement its decision. And this is where the decision gets really interesting because the court is quite prescriptive in telling the government what it needs to do, given that the executive has been so inactive in this area. It says that the rights of the river will be represented by a guardian, with one representative from the government, perhaps the Minister for the Environment, and one representative from the communities. And in doing so, it's lifted the Te Pautupua model from the Whanganui River settlement, and the judgment directly references Whanganui River and the Te Uruwera settlement about forests in New Zealand as well. And the court gave the president and the communities 1 month in order to nominate their guardians, but in fact that's just about to happen at the beginning of September, end of August, beginning of September, so it's taken them a bit longer. But it is happening. And then the court says the guardians have to design and form a commission of guardians for the Atrato River within 3 months. And that includes the designated guardians plus an advisory group of experts made up of some NGOs and universities with experience managing river degradation in Colombia. And that panel needs to make sure that the government actually puts these orders into place. A number of other government departments and entities, the court orders, need to get together and develop a plan to decontaminate the river, the court says. And a number of other government bodies, including military and police, need to get together and develop a plan to wipe out illegal mining along the river. There are a number of other orders for the recuperation of traditional modes of life along the river as well. So if I got a little bit of time to do some analysis, this is definitely a watershed moment for indigenous rights and environmental rights in Latin America. It is a massive decision. It's about 160 pages, the judgment, and it draws heavily on conceptions of indigenous rights and environmental rights in international law, and in particular ILO Convention 169 and Inter-American Court jurisprudence. And that really shows the active involvement of a number of NGOs and also academics and universities who were involved in this case. And it also suggests something towards a bit of an internationalisation of the rights to nature, at least in Latin America. The court explicitly takes an ecocentric approach, and it says that it's doing that. It refers to the interconnectedness of communities, the communities and nature, and the superior position of nature. But the decision is also anthropocentric in the sense that it frames the rights as being what it calls biocultural rights. So we have this idea of the indigenous rights and the river's rights being intrinsically intertwined. That's certainly the case, I think, too, as to what we're seeing in Whanganui River and also in Ecuador and Bolivia. This can possibly have some limitations because it equates indigenous rights with the rights of nature, and that's perhaps something that Virginia was alluding to. It might present tensions with conceptions of ethno-development, perhaps. And it also leaves open the question as to whether the rights to nature can exist in situations where we don't have Indigenous communities. Ultimately, the court does take a human rights-based approach. It's extending conceptions of human rights and applying them to the environment. And in fact, the court refers to these as the third generation of human rights. So the first generation being civil and political, the second being economic, social and cultural, and the third generation of human rights being the rights to nature. The last point I'd like to make is about institutions and enforceability. So as we know, particularly from the examples in Ecuador and Bolivia, that enforcing the rights of nature can be difficult. And this case directly sort of contemplates that it might be difficult and is very prescriptive in terms of telling the government what it needs to do. So we're seeing the courts almost stepping into the role of the executive and telling them how they need to implement the rights of nature. And the court has actually given itself an ongoing role in doing so. It's asked the sort of the Colombian equivalent of the Ombudsman to make sure that its orders are put in place, to give the court quarterly reports as to progress, and if things are not being implemented, the court can call it back in again, call the case back in again. It's a very interesting example of legal personality for a river, and really the remaining thing to see is, does the government rise to the challenge and how do they go about enforcing this, particularly given the other issues that Colombia's got going on at the moment. So I'm heading to Colombia to do some field work at the end of the month, at the time that the guardians are going to be named, and I'm looking forward to interviewing some people from the court and from the government to see what's happening. And Lisa is going to specifically talk now about implementation from the perspective of Tierra Digna, the NGO involved in the case.
Thanks, Liz. So I'm here in back at the law school. I'm also ex-CREAL member, so it's really great to be back here, especially working with colleagues again on these issues. Last year, I was actually doing some work with Tierra Digna, not related to this case, and I obviously stay in the loop with their the different human rights cases that they run. And when this came up, I just had to get in touch with my colleagues to say, have you guys heard about this case? So it's really amazing how these things are all emerging at the same time. I'm here to talk about what's happened since the judgment was handed down. I spoke to my colleagues at the NGO just to get their perspective on the judgment and their ongoing involvement with the communities in Chocó. So they've been working for the last 7 years in Chocó with a number of community councils of Afro-descendant groups and have returned, of course, to work with them in supporting the implementation of the decision. I won't go too much into their perspectives on the judgment itself, but we can leave that for questions, perhaps. In terms of implementation, they were a little nervous. As Liz said, the judgment is quite remarkable in how prescriptive and extensive its orders are, so there was a real fear that there might be some government backlash. Actually, surprisingly, the government has been shown a lot of goodwill, has really stepped up to the mark, and has been playing its part. So in terms of the government side of So there's two parts of the Guardians, the government and the communities. So the government has nominated the Ministry of the Environment, so not a particular person, but the ministry as a whole, to be the institution responsible in that respect. And in terms of the communities themselves, they're holding elections now at the end of the month. So Tierra Digna has been working with them to help do a couple of things. One, make sure the message gets out there about the significance of this case, and also to help convene the elections that are coming up at the end of the month. This case, the sentence, I should say, has restored hope to the people of Chocó. As Liz said, this is an area that's been ravaged by the civil war, that has been left to its own devices by the state. It's got the highest levels of poverty in the whole country. So this has actually given local leaders the ability to step in and take some ownership and hopefully see some real change. So there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. One of the downsides, or one of the one negative fallout of the decision has been that the court ordered that the military get involved to stop. Well, let me backtrack. They said one of the failings of the military was to prevent armed groups engaging in illegal mining. Now, the military have said, oh, as a result of this case brought by these ethnic groups, we are now going in and going to fight these armed combatants, which exposes the applicants in this case to quite severe risk. So I guess the communication strategy hasn't been so well thought out. The ombudsman that Liz mentioned has been playing a really active role in monitoring the implementation of the government's guardian responsibilities, and a number of other departments have also been stepping up to do what they have been ordered to do, so the Department of Health and Education as well. So, well, we'll just see what happens. It's certainly internationalisation in the judgment, we see a lot of that. But also in terms of actors in this space. So Tierra Digna is really interested to connect with people working on these issues in New Zealand, here in Australia, with all of you. And hopefully we can continue this discussion and protect the rights of the river and the communities that depend so much on the river for their livelihood and identity.